Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series power tool accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price, exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.
Welcome to the latest United We Stand podcast. My name is Andy Mitten, and it's a couple of days after Manchester United have been knocked out of the European Cup by Real Madrid. So if I don't sound as enthusiastic as normal, I'm sure you'll understand why. I don't want to fill this podcast with doomlordish talk of what went on at Old Trafford, although I suspect some talk may come into this podcast. But I'm glad to welcome Martin Lipton as our guest today. Martin is the chief football writer for the Daily Mirror. He was at Old Trafford the other night, and he's a high-profile journalist. He's someone who we've known for quite a while, and I thought he'd be a good guest to have on board. He's always honest and forthright with his opinions, and sometimes controversial if you ask QPR fans at the moment. But welcome to United We Stand, Martin.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andy.
You were at Old Trafford the other night. What did you make of it?
Oh, I thought for 56 minutes it was as good a performance in many ways as I've seen from United. It reminded me to a degree of the performance against Barcelona in the 2008 semi-final in terms of nullifying the opposition in a big European game. And having made some huge selection calls at centre-half for one, because Evans has played virtually all season, but the key one with Rooney and being omitted, and Welbeck with doing both of his jobs, first stopping Alonso and then springing off Van Persie extremely well. It was a great evening in the making. I think the way that Giggs helped to patrol the United right side in front of Raphael was really positive as well. There was a sense of an event to remember for a very, very long time coming to pass. And then that happened. We all know what happened, and we all saw what happened, and we all will have our views, I think. And you don't have to be a United fan, and I'm not, to think that they were diddled. It was a poor, poor decision. However, after that, Mourinho acted and struck like a cobra, and for 10 minutes, Sir Alex was slightly passive and inert, and by the time he acted to repair the damage,
I'd agree with a lot of that. I thought it was really entertaining. Two of the biggest teams in world football going at each other end to end. Wonderful atmosphere inside Old Trafford. It fulfilled the expectations that had been building for a couple of months. And I think Ferguson called it absolutely right tactically. I know people were surprised when Wayne Rooney didn't start the game, but Wayne Rooney wasn't, because United had been training with that formation for 3 or 4 days leading up to the match. And I think Rooney could have come on and made a huge impact, and everybody would have been praising Ferguson and possibly even Rooney. Because don't forget, when David Beckham was dropped against Real Madrid 10 years ago, he came on and scored twice.
And I think there was a view that if he scored the third free kick, which just sort of went over the top, could have been the momentum change to take them over the line. Because what people forget from that 2003 game, everyone talks about what a fantastic game it was. It wasn't, because there was no dramatic tension at any point in the evening. If you look back to it, United were at no point in the evening were any closer to going through than they were at kickoff.
Yeah, and there was always a 3 or 4 gap between United and Madrid. United needed to score 3 or 4 goals. And I think that's one of the reasons why Ronaldo was applauded off the pitch. I think had he gone off with the tie level, the applause would have been less enthusiastic. Yeah. And you're right, However, the other night, that contrasted completely. There was that tension. At half-time, I was a bag of nerves. I was thinking, this is brilliant. I'm loving this. This is two really good teams going at each other, cancelling each other out. It's really entertaining. And then that red card came out.
I mean, it was further evidence up to that point of what I've long said, that Champions League knockout stage football is the finest football you will ever see. There's nothing to beat it. People talk about the World Cup, but World Cup teams have got weaknesses. Champions League teams don't, because they are all good, big teams, and they fill the weaknesses with better players. And the game was changed, transformed fundamentally, totally and utterly by that decision by the referee. Now, I understand why he made the call. I just think he was wrong. I mean, he's seen it as a foot far too high, dangerous and reckless, with no thought of the consequences of the action that Nani took. But he didn't see Nani not looking at the player. He didn't recognise that Nani's sole focus was on the ball. And the only moment he recognised that Arbeloa was there was when he made contact. For me, it's a yellow card. But I understand why the referee's seen it as a red. I just think it's a mistake.
Sir Alex Ferguson didn't appear in front of the press or the media after the game. He claimed that he couldn't face the media. Do you believe that?
I think he feared that what he would say would cause so many ruptures with UEFA, with whom he's desperate to stay on side, that he couldn't trust himself. That was the scale of his righteous indignation. I think there's two factors as well, and we'll find out if the second is true in a few months' time. One was the sheer anger at the decision and the way that it transformed the game. Maybe similar to that was a view that perhaps he had been caught up in the emotion and allowed himself to be distracted by the response to the event as opposed to the tactical response that was required, as was demonstrated by Mourinho. But possibly, and we'll know soon enough, maybe this was his last chance. Maybe he has made a decision that with the 20th title for United in the bag, having seen off once again pretenders to the crown, and so fundamentally and totally as they would have done by the end of the season, because I can see them winning by 12 or points or more, and at 71, he might have been thinking about this one being the last season. I don't know. We'll find out soon enough. And that the frustration of missing out when, with the expectation that Barcelona probably go out, because no team has ever come back from a 2-0 deficit in the Champions League, the view feeling may well have been that beat Real Madrid and it's there. It's there to be won at Wembley in May.
And then Sir Alex walks into the sunset, heralded as the greatest ever.
Well, I think he'll be heralded as the greatest ever anyhow, to be proved to be for the good years. I mean, let's be honest, there's nothing like him. He's been a force of nature in every sense. Yes, there are flaws in him. Even the greatest gods have feet of clay, don't they? He is one of those. He has his failings and his flaws and his human faults. He's also the finest manager we'll ever see. I don't think anyone should pretend otherwise.
I wouldn't be surprised if he stepped down this summer, would you?
I wouldn't, actually, because he learned the lesson 10 years ago, didn't he? Yeah. Which was, don't pre-announce. If you're going to do it, just do it. At the time of your choosing. And as I said, having seen off another pretender, you know, we had it over the last few years, we had Wenger being the new dominant force, seen off. Mourinho, the new dominant force, seen off. Remember, he came in seeing off the original dominant force in Liverpool. That was his stated aim, very swiftly accomplished. And then now City, with all of the money that they've had behind them, who won the title last year and deserved to win the title last year. United may have thrown it away at the end, but City were the better team, I think, throughout the season. But having seen them off so outstandingly and clearly this season, you know, everything that's been put in his front, in front of him, every challenge has been met head on. It seemed to be the perfect time this season to walk into the sunset and just say, go on then, you know, as in the old Ozymandian thing, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.
What did you make of Mourinho after the game? Because it was almost the anti-Mourinho. It wasn't like it was him. Okay, on one level with the Spanish media, he used it to get equal with his enemies, the people who'd been questioning his purchases, Modric, dropping Casillas. But with the British media, he struck a very conciliatory tone.
I wasn't expecting that version of Mourinho. I'm used to the sparring Mourinho, the braggart Mourinho, the Mourinho who wants himself to be the story. And he was going out of his way from the moment he arrived in Manchester to not be the story. And I suspect that the main reason of that is he wanted to send out a message to the people who matter at Manchester United. And that message was, you can trust me. I don't have to cause rucks. I just want to be a football manager. I want to manage at this great club. Because he does. He's never hidden that. He believes that he is one of the very few who have it within themselves to take over from a legend. And we've, you know, at United, when Matt Busby went, the problems that there were in taking over from legends, other clubs have had that same issue in the past. He believes in himself so totally and fundamentally that he believes he can do that. But he also knows that there is significant opposition from within the upper echelons of Old Trafford. He also knows that one of the main impediments to that is taking a step down in his role. The departure of David Gill as chief executive into a lesser role while still on the board does alter the dynamic within the boardroom. We know that Sir Bobby's also been antithetical at best and downright hostile in certain elements about Mourinho. His role appears to have been somewhat diminished as well, just through the passage of time, I guess. So he might feel that there is a chance to make that positive impression. And I have to say, although I thought his gesture in the last seconds of injury time was somewhat disrespectful, his comments afterwards would not have harmed his case or his cause whatsoever.
Nor will the fact that the two main obstacles, as you said, one of them's moving on in the summer, the other's been is not doing any more public duties, and he's putting on his best public face now. He's also well aware of if he leaves Real Madrid and he wants to go to one of the top three clubs in the world, but one of them's Barcelona. They didn't take him in 2008. They flew to Porto. They flew to Lisbon. They met him. They spoke to him. They were convinced that he would do a good job. However, they harboured serious doubts about his conduct with the media and they didn't go for his personality and gave the job to Pep Guardiola. The other club is Manchester United. So he doesn't have a huge number of...
Well, the other one is Manchester City, you could argue.
No, but in terms of... If I was saying that the three biggest football clubs in the world, judged by support, history, stadium size, revenues... It's United,
Barcelona and Madrid. But so the other thing is the other team that you might think with their budget would be an option for him is City.
Yeah.
Of course, the two people at Barcelona who turned him down there, Soriano and Begiristan, are now the two people running City. So yeah. One wonders whether he might feel that that's no longer in his remit. I've always found with Mourinho, he's at his best when he can be an outsider trying to destabilise the establishment. He did it at Chelsea. He loved the way he could play the game at Chelsea. If you remember at Chelsea, it was always the FA are biased, it's David Dean running the FA, it's all in favour of Arsenal, look at the treatment they give Arsene Wenger. Had he gone to City, he could have played that same game with David Gill as the bête noire. So that would have been a possibility, but that's not going to happen, I don't think, now. He wants United. He does.
United are on target for a record, not just a Premier League points haul, but a record haul in the club's entire history. And the main difference seems to be, even if you compare the current team to the great recent United side, the treble winners, the double winners in 94 and 96, they're not drawing any matches. They've drawn 2 of 28 games. So
that's the key thing. They don't draw. They either win. They've lost 3 and won the rest. I mean, it's incredible, a remarkable. And of those draws, I mean, one of those was a last minute equaliser at Spurs.
And
the other one, Swansea. I mean, they've been absolutely incredible in games they've stolen at the death. And that's a true mark of a team. that they can do it time and time and time again, because it isn't easy so to keep doing it.
So if this United team isn't as great as past teams, despite getting more points, is the issue with the opponents? Is the Premier League weaker than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Unquestionably, Andy. And there's no argument with that. If you look at... it's a perfect year, actually, 2008. The only teams that could beat the English teams in the Champions League were the English teams. There was not a weakness in either team in that final. In that final in Moscow, there was not a weak player on the pitch. There were really good players who didn't even get in the 19, in the 18, in the case of United, with Park. Yeah. I mean, he couldn't get on the bench. That was how good that United side was. And for those who say, oh, well, Park, hang on, how many big games after that was he trusted in? All the big games, it seemed, Fergie played him because he really thought he could do a job. The clubs are, you know, Chelsea's team in that final, they had Essien, they had Ballack, they had Carvalho, they had, you know, Drogba. Look at them now. Look at the Liverpool team they beat to get to the, Chelsea beat to get to that final. Fantastically talented teams. The standard has gone down. I think there's been a levelling up, a levelling across the board in the Premier League. I think the teams at the bottom are better now than they were 5 years ago. But the teams at the top are worse.
As a Tottenham fan, how will you feel if Gareth Bale leaves the club in the summer and if he joins Manchester United? Does he need to leave the club to step up and move on to the next level, or can he do that at Tottenham?
Well, I think if Tottenham finish in the top four, he will stay. There are reasons for that. One, he doesn't want to leave. Two, his parents, with whom he has a very close relationship, don't want him to leave. And three, surprisingly, at this stage at least, his agent isn't pushing for him to leave. The other thing you've got to take into account is that Daniel Levy will not sell to another English club. And it's easy to say, oh, yes, he will. I said 2 summers ago that Daniel Levy would not sell Luka Modric to Chelsea, whatever the offer was. And the offer was, in the end, over £40 million. And Tottenham simply refused to sell. Levy has a bee in his bonnet about United. He thinks he owes them still. He feels he got one back over Friars in January, but he still owes them for Carrick, who he didn't want to sell, and particularly for Berbatov. He still has revenge in his heart over the way that he was trying to sell Berbatov to City. He'd agreed a deal with City and Fergie brilliantly, but, you know, showing in a way that, you know, people wouldn't like if you're on the receiving end of it, stole him at the airport. He's not forgotten. Daniel's a shrewd businessman. He will sell Gareth Bale when the time is right. If Spurs aren't top four, he'll go this summer because he won't try and keep him. He knows he can't. But when Bale leaves Tottenham, I can only see it, knowing Daniel Levy as I do, I can only see it being to a European club, probably to Madrid or Barcelona, whichever one of those comes up with the biggest wedge. But you wouldn't discount Bayern Munich, to be fair, given that Guardiola's there and that they are extremely wealthy.
You've always been a Tottenham fan. What have been your high points and low points of being a Tottenham fan? And did you used to go to matches before you became a journalist?
My first memory was in 1972 when I was six, and I looked it up. It was in October, and they beat Stoke 4-3. I used to go when my dad did lots of things. He was a cab driver and a bookmaker and a double glazing salesman. And to be fair, he was, you name it, he ducked and dived a little bit as well. He's a typical North London Jew. His mentality was that every day you've got to try and do a deal. He was a Spurs fan who grew up in North London. I followed him into the family business, as it were, in that respect. I mean, fortunately, I didn't spend too much time selling windows because I was rubbish at it. But there are plenty of people who say I'm rubbish at this, to be fair, but that's a different issue. But I used to go on a regular basis when I was very young, when he wouldn't take me or couldn't take me because he was working, and Orient were at home because we lived in Walthamstow then. I'd walked a mile down the road to see Orient. But Spurs were my team. When we moved out to Essex, which we did when I was about 11, I used to get on the train to Liverpool Street on a Saturday morning. I used to stand initially on the shelf, which was that raised area, which was fantastic view. And then after that, behind the goal at the Paxton Road end, which from the TV cameras, if you know Spurs, it's the goal to your right, where Van Persie scored his header this season. It's my club. It has been for nearly, 40 years. Crikey, I'm old. Not too many high points, but you're a Spurs fan. Actually, probably the biggest high was while I was working, which was watching them beat Milan in the Champions League two or three years ago in the San Siro. As a Spurs fan, you don't get much better than that because you didn't expect it. It came out of nothing, that run. They were terrific, until they came up against Mourinho and Madrid and fell apart when Crouch lost his marbles, sadly, early on. Low points, far too many. I mean, I remember relegation, even though I was 11 in 77-8. I remember the 87 Cup final. I managed to lose against Coventry. Coventry? How'd you lose to Coventry?
It's famous Cup final.
And right? The other thing about that, people remember, or maybe not, if you look at the video of that game, half the Spurs players had the sponsors logo on their shirts, but not the other half, because there'd been a mess up in the dressing room beforehand. Typical Spurs. I remember, the excitement when they signed Gascoigne, and to join Lineker and Waddle, only for them to lose Waddle within about a week, which is a real shame because Waddle was a fantastic player there. I was very lucky. I saw Glenn Hoddle in his pomp from a 17-year-old up to the time he left in 87, and there were some of the things there took your mind away. They were fantastic. He was a brilliant player. He was the best technical player I'd seen at Tottenham until I saw Berbatov. Who was a genius at Spurs. He was a marvellous player. The languidness did irritate sometimes, but what a player he was. And I was amazed that he didn't really inherit the mantle of Cantona at United, because I thought he was going to be outstanding and magnificent in United. It didn't quite work out. He's got all the talent in the world, still a wonderful, wonderful player. But the last few years, I have to say, have been very different, because Spurs have actually suddenly become a good team. Not a good cup team who could occasionally play, but a genuinely good team. Because Spurs have never come fourth, fifth, fourth in my memory. Hopefully this year will be fourth, fifth, fourth, third. There's something building there for the first time that genuinely makes you think that they could become a proper team, as opposed to a team that go to a certain point and then fall apart. And it's been thrilling to watch that development. Of the team that you support. I mean, I don't watch them very often for the very reason that I do support them. And I find it... I mean, Sunday, I was at the North London Derby. It's the game I hate most. I loathe watching it because I can't watch it. I just find it too difficult to watch that game because you have to try and maintain a degree of professional detachment. And it's bloody hard when you're playing Arsenal. It really is. You know that when you play City. It's hard. And when you play Liverpool, it's hard. And for that game for me is awful, and I loathe it. And obviously, when the final whistle goes and your side wins, it's fantastic. But then I've got to get back to my professional head again very swiftly because I've got a job to do. But it is, as I find it easier to watch teams that I don't, where I'm disinterested in the result, just because I can be entirely professional. I try to be. If anything, I'm more critical of Tottenham than any other team because of that. Because I don't want to be accused of being biased in their favour. And I don't think I am. I think over the body of work over the years, I've slaughtered them more than any other team I know. Because, they're easy to slaughter, let's be honest. You've seen them over the years like I have.
2 points. You mentioned the game against Milan a couple of years ago. I interviewed Joe Jordan just before that game. I met him at Liverpool Street Station and we went for a coffee and he was initially grumpy, but then he warmed up and he was fantastic, and I spoke to him for 2 hours and he was raving about his time in Italy and how he was looking forward to going back there and seeing old friends in less challenging circumstances, and when he'd been a player and he'd received a bit of abuse from the fans. And then he had that little spat with Gattuso, so I was watching that thinking that didn't quite work out how you expected, Joe.
And you mentioned... That was fun and games, although I remember that sort of, It was one of those with Jordan that he was the one who thought he had to fight the fight for everybody, and to be fair, he did. Gattuso was mad that night, to be honest, wasn't he?
And you mentioned signings which Manchester United have made from Spurs. There's another one off the field who was really significant for United, Edward Friedman.
Yeah.
He was in charge of your merchandise operation, which in 1991 meant that Tottenham Hotspur had a bigger overall revenue than Manchester United. It's bizarre to think of that. Now, and he was tempted to come up to Old Trafford. He saw the potential, he realised the potential. The megastore was down to him. The club magazine was down to him. The idea for the television station was down to him. And he had a huge success in Manchester before, you know, having a disagreement and moving on. But he was the first person who'd realised the potential of Manchester United, not just in the UK, but in Ireland, Europe and globally as well.
He's a massive job. Also, there's a link now because, of course, John Alexander, who was the Spurs secretary yes. for a very long time, has now got the job at Old Trafford. And he was called into the midnight meeting with UEFA on Wednesday after the game to try and persuade them not to charge United for Alex's no-show. And John's a very, very good man as well, I have to say, a genuinely decent bloke who I know will do a fantastic job for United. Look, to be fair, if you don't do a good job for United, there's something wrong, because it is one of the greatest clubs there'll ever be. It's a wonderful, wonderful institution. I love going to United, always have done. And I used to think now that there's sometimes more passion than there used to be. I think that 08 game against Barcelona, I really remember, because that was a wall of sound.
Yeah.
And that helped propel second half. It was all hands to the pump, and the fans played a massive, massive role. But I also remember the semi-final the previous year, against Milan, where you were 2-1 down, and that the fans helped turn it around, and that foul, foul night. It was a wonderful evening. Shame you didn't turn up for the first 20 minutes in the San Siro, as you remember, because you got battered then.
Well, that was partly because Vidic had just come back from injury, and he was torn out of position three or four times in the first 10 minutes. But you're right about that Barcelona atmosphere. It was probably the best I've ever experienced at Old Trafford. And that wasn't at a time when the Stretford End was a terrace. This was the all-seater stadium. It shows how good Old Trafford can be. And that frustrates a lot of fans because they wish it was like that more often. Now, you're never going to get atmospheres like Barcelona at home every single week. But if you could just get to half of that level, Old Trafford would be a far better place for that.
Well, I think you always want that. I mean, look, as you know, Andy, you've been to Spurs, which is a very small ground. It's only 38,000. It's without question the best atmosphere in London by a mile. And it helps from our perspective in the media because we're so low. And if you watch for those who don't recognise, if you watch the dugouts at Spurs on the telly, immediately behind that dugout, the away visiting dugout, is the media, is the press box. You're that close to the action. You sense the occasion. And at other London clubs, I mean, the Emirates is a wonderful stadium. It is as flat as a pancake. Chelsea, there's no atmosphere. Big clubs, you want to have something special when you go in the ground, that it, on a big occasion, an organic feel. I do wonder, and I've always felt this for a long time, I just wish that sometimes there wasn't any pre-match nonsense from the PR, from the PA. That the fans were encouraged to get in for a big game early and to make the game come alive, to make it organic, to make it grow, to make it a sense of occasion. Too often, 5 minutes before kickoff, the ground's still empty. Every club, and if people were there earlier, sometimes for a really big night, to make that occasion, to make it feel like a special night for them, different to normal, then it might have an effect as well.
At Old Trafford the other night, they turned the public address off for 5 minutes before the game to allow the fans to build the atmosphere.
I thought that worked.
It did work.
I really thought it was a good idea because then you just got that anticipation. That sense of this is special, and I think it certainly helped for the set tone of the match. The way that the twist by changing the announcement of the team, so Ronaldo was the last one whose name was roared out, and all of that, it did have a psychological effect. That was really quite canny, and that's obviously Fergie's call. He's been responsible for that. It did have an effect, and you can. Whatever people say, it's not like Reading with the silly thing on the team sheet about, our 13th man, the Reading fan, all of that.
Yeah.
But if it's just 1% or 2% to one or two players for both teams, for the home side or the away side, having an effect on them, in games of that magnitude, where it is the one or two mistakes that decide the game, try it, give it a go, find a way, because fans are still part of football. Without the fans, there is no football.
Another little change United made the other night, again down to Ferguson, was the ball boys. They were all under-18s players. He didn't want any messing about if United were chasing a late winner. Didn't quite work out how Ferguson hoped it would have done. You mentioned the atmosphere at London Grounds. What would it be like if you walked into the Queen's Park Rangers boardroom tomorrow, given the story that you wrote about them last week? And a lot of our listeners won't be familiar with the story, so if you could just explain that to them.
Well, I wrote a story which was published on Saturday, which was over the back three pages of the newspaper, which stated from conversation I'd had with three members of the QPR squad, senior players who've made over 50 appearances for them this season, that the week-long training camp in Dubai, which was ahead of the United game at Loftus Road, was, in the words of the players, more like a stag party. And I know this story to be true. It caused eruption. I was called all sorts. I was called. It was called disgusting and a fabrication by the manager of Police Park Rangers.
But he didn't deny it.
Well, he tried to deny it. What I would point out, and still will point out, is that if you look at the club website, there is no denial. If you look at the Twitter feed of Philip Beard, Battier, or Tony Fernandez, there is no denial. I'm still waiting for my cease and desist letter to ask me to take it off of the mirrorfootball.co.uk website. I'm still waiting for the legal letter, if it's such an outrageous, disgusting and fabricated story. I'm still waiting for the complaint. I'm still waiting for any denials. But I don't think they'd be offering me champagne if I went in the boardroom, to be fair.
How do you find the interaction now with readers, with Twitter and social media when you break a story like that? Because a lot of QPR fans won't have liked reading that because it was you were the bearer of bad news.
Look, I like Twitter. I enjoy. Look, and United fans know that I engage. I did a thing a few weeks ago which caused huge rows with them over a list. I did it for all the top six of players that I thought were good enough for the club. And, of course, I think that a club like United have different standards than other clubs. And the two calls that seem to be most questionable I stand by them, although I'm willing to hear an argument particularly for one of them. I didn't think that Raphael and Evans were quite good enough for United. And I've got relentless abuse from many United fans. Fine, because it's my opinion. I like that. I don't shy away from it. No United fan could ever claim that I run away from the debate. I like the debate. I don't like abuse. When people abuse me, and when they make what I would say are sick insults about me and my family, why should I cope with that? If you want to say I'm wrong, that's fine. Never a problem. I like the argument. I genuinely enjoy the joust because I love the game. I'm a football fan who gets paid to watch it. I'm a very, very lucky man, and I know that, and I don't pretend otherwise. And, you know, some of the best nights of my life have been watching teams that I don't support, watching Chelsea in the Champions League final, watching United play in magnificent games, watching Arsenal play great games, watching Liverpool, anyone. I love watching big football teams, big games. I love the fact that everyone has an opinion. What I can't stand, and it bores the bits off me, is this, the media are all out for us. It's an agenda. We're all ABUs. You all hate Liverpool. You all hate Arsenal. You got it in for Chelsea. No, we haven't. We're just doing a job. There's no media agenda against any club. There's no FA agenda against any club. There's no UEFA agenda against any club. It's a nonsense, an utter nonsense. And I just wish sometimes people would stand back and see that people just have opinions.
Football fans are often like that. They'll accuse you of being something that you're not. They'll also accuse you of saying something that you haven't said. You're a newspaper journalist. Are you optimistic about the future of newspapers? There's been a lot of change. There's been a lot of cutbacks. A lot of colleagues who you know at other newspapers have lost their job recently. Some of them very, very good operators. What's your take on the whole future with the internet, with monetising the industry?
I have to say, I think there'll be an evolution. I do think the printed form of newspapers, as it were, is in decline, clearly. It's about managing that decline. But there are also, with the advent of the digital age, opportunities. I think the growing number of newspaper apps on iPads, etc., which are a version of the newspaper in electronic form,
yeah,
as the paper looks, but with instead of pictures, having video and things like that where you can interact, that's really positive. The only question I have is where you monetize it, where you make the money. Let's be honest, one of the reasons that the Murdoch group are so, and the Mail as well, are so determined to destroy the BBC is because while the BBC website exists in its current form, you cannot monetize the internet because everything you need, effectively, is available for free on the BBC. You just aren't going to make enough money because the Beeb is so brilliant in terms of the breadth of its coverage. Don't you agree with it all? You can, you know, it's just the sheer breadth of its coverage is remarkable. And therefore, why would you pay? Certainly in the numbers required to make the internet a financial success for newspapers, why would you pay when you can get it for nothing? So there have to be different ways of engaging and bringing people aboard. I think there's always going to be a desire to read about football. Football's never been more popular. It's never been more democratic writing about football. You know, it's no longer purely the 10 chief football writers who write about England or about Manchester United or Chelsea. Everyone is able to write now. I do think that sometimes people don't realise there's a difference between having an opinion and having some insight and knowledge about why you have that opinion. And I do think, that's not to say they're wrong to have an opinion. It's great that people have an opinion. But sometimes people who've been doing the job for a long time might know a little bit more. They may know the people they're talking about. They may know why things happen. Not always, because I'm not going to tell you that I'm right all the time. In fact, I wouldn't mind being right some of the time. That'd be a start. There are certain of my colleagues who, if I had a scintilla of their self-belief, I would be a different sort of character. But I like, you know, I don't think I know all the answers. I don't. I just have opinions. I think that some of them are valid. I hope that all of them are interesting. I certainly think also that we're in the entertainment business, and sometimes you do things because they're there to provoke. One of the things, there are two or three things that do annoy me, Andy. It's one, this is, you know what? You're just trying to get stories. Well, yeah, actually. You're just trying to sell newspapers. Well, yeah, actually. You know, those two things are sort of the raison d'etre of being a newspaper journalist, aren't they?
They are, and I think you make some good points about monetising it. I noticed the Mirror, they've got an app which you can download for free. You can now read the Mirror for free, and it just strikes me as strange because you had to pay for the Mirror until recently, and you can apply that argument across several newspapers. I noticed that the New York Times are having a lot of success with their paywall structure where they let readers access 5 stories and then they have to pay for any more than that. And initially, cynics were sceptical about it, but it's working, and that's been a successful business model. It'll be interesting to see how it all works out.
I think the Telegraph have tried a similar sort of thing. If you're trying to access the Telegraph from abroad, I think you're only allowed 10 free hits in a calendar month or something like that. So that may be a model that can be followed, as opposed to a full monetization, because I'm not sure what Murdoch has done with the Times has been that successful to make it something it could roll out across the entire group. And, you know, a niche publication like the FT can, because it's the only publication that has that detail. But because of the all-consuming nature of sport in terms of the breadth of coverage in so many different media now, I'm not sure that you can do that for a simple newspaper model.
And the niche publication like United We Stand, because we've got bills to pay as well, we've got print bills to pay, and we charge people to download our digital edition, yeah, where you can read it on your tablet or whatever.
You're niche as well, aren't you? Because you have got a very, very specific target audience.
Yeah, and it's working well.
It'll basically be United fans. There might be some others as well,
yeah,
and hopefully there will be. I mean, I think that it's great that there is this opportunity and to put, you know, talk to various people about after the game. But you have a niche audience, which makes it more viable, I think, somehow to charge than when you're trying to get a huge market share.
We also have to offer insight as well. When people buy United We Stand and pay for it, they want to be told something they haven't been told before. So we'd use our contacts, just like you do.
Absolutely.
We have writers. We have to offer something because there's so much on the web, but a lot of it is not very good. So we've got to offer something where people think, that's £2. You know what? That's worth paying for.
There was something I really like reading the stuff that Michael Cox does in Zona Marketing. I think that's fantastic. There's nowhere else you could get that. You couldn't get it in a newspaper because there isn't space in a newspaper for that level of tactical, discussion and illustration. Apart from, you know, Gary Neville can do a little bit on a Monday night, and The Guardian can do a little bit on a Monday morning, but it's literally one aspect of a game. But Michael does it fantastically. It's brilliant to watch, to read. I really likewise. I like the Anders Green, the Swiss Ramble stuff. It's, you know, all of these things, various different people. I think they're great. The people who give insight are fantastic, and they have an ability. The internet gives them the chance to do something that is not available in the mainstream media and never can be available in the mainstream media. We're all part of the same industry, though.
We've been speaking for 50 minutes now. I told you it'd only take 35 minutes of your time. So thank you very much. If you have to predict the rest of this season, do you just see Manchester United winning the league, or can they win the FA Cup as well?
Oh, they certainly can do both. Maybe that would be the fitting way for him to go. It would be a fitting way for him to go, actually. If it is the last season, then let's see Fergie win the double, because nobody could begrudge Britain's, the world's greatest manager, that finish.
Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
So that's it for this episode of the United We Stand podcast. I'd like to make another special thanks for this one to Bram Brooks. When we recorded this podcast, it corrupted completely, and we thought that we'd lost the whole podcast. Bram spent 3 hours on it in Manchester on Thursday night, so thank him for that. The new United We Stand is out. It came out against Real Madrid. It will be on sale in the shops, the usual distribution points, over the weekend. The digital subscription is available for download now from iTunes or through our website if you've got an Android device, and it will be on sale outside Old Trafford before the Chelsea game and the Reading game. Until next week, goodbye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com, Upwork.com.